Welcome aboard, everybody, to the Same Boat podcast. And I am so happy to be here with Wilson and Jenna. The topic of today is the experience of having no voice, and particularly in the immigrant church. And I hope that, you know, as we share different stories and experiences, that even if, you know, you, the listener, didn't have an experience exactly like ours, whether, you know, you were in a different role in the church or whatever, that there's something about the human experience of having no voice that can really resonate for you and make you feel like you're not alone in that aspect, that there are others, you know, in the same boat as you. But it's an important experience that I know is not just unique to us three, but it's something that I've noticed and heard in quite a few people who have been in the immigrant church context. So thanks again, Wilson and Jenna, for joining me on this episode. I'd love to go into this this theme and just talk about stories where we felt like we had no voice, especially in the immigrant church context. So you want to start by sharing a story?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what Jenna shared on the last episode was really helpful, where we have overlap between our church life and our family life in the immigrant home. And I think one of the stories that comes to mind was I was helping out with the church planting class, and we were having lunch, a lunch break, so I was walking to lunch with the Chinese pastor. And I was like, oh yeah, when I worked at an English ministry, I felt like a secondary citizen. We always get ran over, we had no voice. He's like, I give my English minister like a bunch of room and margin. Like, he could kind of do anything he wants as long as it doesn't violate the bylaws. I was like, wow, that's a lot of space, really cool. Mm-hmm. We have lunch at the cafeteria, and then we're strolling back at Biola to the classroom again. And now I'm standing with the English minister. And we're still in the same big group, but I'm like, hey, I hear your Chinese pastor gives you so much freedom that you just have to obey the bylaws.
This nervous laughter now. That's what's going to happen
here. And he is like, no, I feel so restrained. Wow. And he gave a list of what he cannot do. Man. And like, they're walking 10 feet from each other, but they are 100 miles apart.
Wow.
to experience that, I think encapsulates so much of how the CM and EM can look at the same structure and situation, but have like a totally different perspective.
That's so true.
we're going to be talking a lot about having no voice, but, you know, and I'll probably mention this a few times, but I really want to emphasize how, as you know, because I'm work as a mental health professional, having no voice, especially for a sustained period of time, it's just going to wear down on your psyche. And I feel like if we don't either address the fact that we don't have any voice, or if we don't make some sort of executive move so that we can find a way that our voice actually matters, if we don't do that, then I think it's going to have long-term negative effects, you know, for us. And that's probably going to leak out in a very, very bad way. So I'm anticipating a really fruitful discussion today about this, because I think it's good for us to be able to externalize what that's like. But again, for the listeners, if the listeners feel like there's some situation where there is no real avenue for your voice to be heard or respected or to be taken into consideration, there needs to be some recognition that the longer that continues, the longer, maybe the greater the potential that your mental health is suffering because of that. So I want that to be something that is heard loud and clear. So,
yeah, and I think Asian American society, or Asian society, is almost built on not having a voice. Hmm. One person having a voice, one person not having. So in the Confucius concept and philosophy, there's a teacher and a student, right? The teacher speaks, the student doesn't speak. There's the ruler and the civilian. The ruler speaks, gives laws, the civilian is quiet, obeys them. There's the parent and child. And so the societal construct is extremely hierarchical, and there's not really a feedback loop. It's top down. So when I think about that at my church, I remember staff meetings were on Tuesdays, and on Mondays I went mountain biking trying to break my arm. Like, I did all the biggest jumps. I went to new tracks because I'm like, I'd rather break my arm than go to staff meeting. And even now, my parents live off of the same exit as my old church. I remember for years, I would hit that exit, I would see the car dealership, and I would feel really anxious. I would feel really nervous for years and years, like into my mid-30s. And it was such an experience of having no voice where we do 3 to 4 hours of staff meeting, right? We would sing Chinese songs. And in the Chinese worship, they forced us to do hand motions.
Oh.
So as like a 25-year-old...
Body motion?
Yes.
Seriously?
Like Napoleon Dynamite, Happy Hands Club?
Yes, all of that.
Yeah.
It's like, if I wasn't worshiping with my hands, I wasn't worshiping, but they were like the most embarrassing moves that you can think of.
Can you
There's
show?
Some marching.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like a lot of this, a lot of this, a lot of hands, too many hands. And then the pastor would have us all make sure that we're doing our devotionals. And so he was really honing on me because I wasn't maybe doing it as much as I should. So he would take my devotional, he would flip through it. And he was like, oh, I see a lot of blank spots. He would read them out loud sometimes.
What?
So it doesn't feel like there's a lot of privacy. And then after that, we would... you know, do some prayer for different things in the church. But the most brutal part of staff meeting is that there would be about 35 staff. And then he would ask every single person, what did you do last week? And he would have one-on-one meetings in a big circle in a room with every single person. And everyone would report to him. He would give feedback. And they would do a mini meeting 35 times, all in Chinese. I'm the only one who speaks Chinese in my little EM staff of three, so I have to translate for them. And I'm just like, the maintenance guy wants to talk the loudest. He's always mad, you know? So they hear him talk for 20 minutes. And then he'll ask, what are you going to do this week? And another round.
Oh,
my goodness. Death by meeting. So I'm just so exhausted.
Death by meeting.
And, like, when I stopped translating, my EM pastor would be upset. Like, come on, tell me what the janitor said. I'm like, it doesn't matter. None of this matters. Our whole life does not matter. And so it's just like a third of the time. 1/35th of the time we were having a relevant conversation. So there was just that whole experience, and then there was all these like mini episodes of like them forcing us to do things as a church that we didn't want to do. So we have like citywide parades, and they wanted us to wear like the most gaudy church shirts.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to describe it. It's like the print is like this big. And it's like striped inside the font and like the worst font. And then we had to do hand motions in the middle of a street and form like a cross and form a heart with 30 of us. We had to go to political rallies that a lot of us didn't believe in or didn't feel comfortable like being represented that way. But as a staffer, you just had to show up and you had to get everyone else to show up too. So I just felt this huge... tug of war between the things I felt like were helpful to EM, were relevant, and the things that my senior pastor wanted to do. And either I could pull with him and please him, but I'm pulling against our ministry, against what's helpful, or I pull with the EM and he feels like, you know, I'm rebelling against him.
Okay. Any instance?
Well, I have a question for Wilson, like just with that experience, like how much do you think like that tension you experienced was like cultural, like what you brought up initially of just the dynamics of Chinese culture versus American culture and like straddling that and trying to resolve that and find a way to sort of fit into like a very dominant culture that's very Chinese.
Yeah.
And how much of that is like truly, I guess, like biblical, gospel oriented? Like, how much were you guys actually working through like differences that were biblically theology oriented versus more just like cultural differences? Because I guess in my head, I'm almost thinking like there's two separate buckets of maybe issues at play. There's like the stuff that's just cultural that like in any context, when it's Chinese meets American or Korean or any Asian culture, there's something to work through. Mm. And then there's also like this other element of how culture informs theology and the way that we live out our faith and the conflicts that naturally emerge out of that. Mm. And just maybe a certain lens on like what the gospel even looks like based off of cultural background. So I guess I'm just curious, like, if you have any thoughts on that, like the theology versus the cultural element.
Yeah, it was everything.
It was all of it.
So there was like structural stuff that we talked about where, you know, we were just totally not like, we would go to a meeting fighting 3 hours for like, can we use another version of the Bible? And it would be no, you know, so it's like we couldn't have any room space there. But then also what was really frustrating on the theology side is that I could not control the pulpit. I could not protect the pulpit for the people that I had been pastoring for many years at that point. And our church would swing theologically so hard. So we would have, I remember there was a gal who preached on Jesus coming back in our generation and defining that within 20 years, Jesus is going to come back.
Like a prediction.
Like a prediction. Mm. Another person said Jesus will come back in a spaceship. So it just got more and more weird. And I remember talking to my EM pastor. I said, hey, if you don't correct her, I have to do it. Like, I'm going to go up and tell people, like, that's not... Mm-hmm. I'm going to read the Matthew passage, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like, you go do it. And it's like... And then we had all these guest speakers come in. One of them was, like, a nutrition person. But he had no... His master's was in business. And somehow we were listening to him talk about nutritional facts. And his suggestion was that everyone eat bananas with the banana peel.
What?
So we have all these Chinese people eating bananas with the banana peel at church. Like monkeys peel their bananas. Monkeys. What's under a monkey, right? And it's just like, there was another very fundamentalist group who said you had to homeschool your kids. And when you go to the more advanced materials, Bill Gother, who never had kids, they show you what colors boys are supposed to wear and the 3 haircuts they can have. So our pastor never had huge like swings. I can say like I pretty much trusted his theology, but he would just let anyone in. And I would be so upset with that. One more example. For like a couple of years, we had a magical prayer where you would stand up. We would stand on your left and right and someone would pray for you. And it's like Moses, Aaron, and Miriam praying for this person, right? So we have to stand in a specific shape. And then the person prays a specific prayer. The contents of that prayer is like pretty good. But then the belief that they put in that prayer was like, you would be slain in the spirit. You would be healed of your disease. God would listen to this magical prayer. And I just felt so frustrated, Jenna, by the theology might have frustrated me more. I think I could kind of take the structural, very Chinese hierarchy, but when the theology was swinging everywhere from, I felt like I went to 6 different extreme churches in one, like a value pack, you know? I experienced all of the Christendom weird stuff. That drove me nuts because I couldn't protect the people I was supposed to pastor and shepherd.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I'm thinking about the no voice, and it's interesting because the way that you just painted like maybe that like leadership was almost like there was an invitation for a lot of
every voice
full spectrum, but then at the same time like suppression as well of like having a voice.
Wait, so you said, so he said go ahead, so you went up there and you talked about how you can't predict that Jesus comes back.
Yeah.
And what happened?
And then it was awkward. And it wasn't the lead pastor. It was the EM pastor who gave me that permission.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then she called me later and we tried to talk through it. And I told her, like, she's trying to point to some examples. Like, Jerusalem got retaken after World War II. You know, they're about to rebuild the temple. Jesus says in one generation, you know, in Matthew, I think, 25. And I was like... And basically we were debating in scripture. Yeah, and then at the end of the day, she drops this. She says, your senior pastor invited me to that pulpit. So I kind of going all the way back to like, I just could not protect the pulpit. And as a shepherd, it was extremely frustrating. Yeah. And he would just say, oh, we just throw the baby. We don't want to, you know, we have to filter. Or like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, there's good here too.
So that, so, you know, you talked about the staff meetings. You know, you talked about the pulpit experience. Was this the beginning of the end for you? Or was that kind of like in the middle? Or was that the last straw? Like, where does that fit in the timeline
for you? Oh, yeah, great question. I think the theology going awry, that really started breaking trust. And then I went to seminary. And then I went to, like, Berean, when Berean was, like, a little small group at Pastor Peter's house. And I was like, and then I went MacArthur, you know? I went into the loving, stable arms of MacArthur. Like, he'll never move. He might as well be made of stone, you know? His hands forged with, like, Bible turning. And I'm not there anymore, but I really felt like he grounded me in ways that my church never could. And it broke me away from my church. And it showed me, like, there are a lot of things, but that was the thing I didn't know how to recover from. And maybe I don't think I should have recovered from that. Because every time I brought it up, it wasn't important. You know, I bring direct scripture against, like, eating banana with a banana peel, right? As a way of spirituality. And it didn't matter. It was almost like it wasn't a big deal.
You know, typically when people experience something that feels futile, either people will get super aggressive to fight back, or they will sort of die inside and become really depressed. Like their outlook will now seem really dark and like, what am I supposed to do here? Like, you know, let's say if I have a family to support and yet this seems futile and I don't have another job lined up, do I need to stay in this path for how long?
Yeah.
You know, or whatever it might be. So do you remember what that feeling of frustration or even futility felt like for you, or where it led to?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think I fought a lot. And then I started giving up. And then I was diagnosed with depression for about 4 or 5 months. Because I didn't want to leave this church. I had been there my whole life. I had been on staff for 10 years. There were a lot of people I loved there. And what brought me out of it by God's grace was actually an invitation by my senior pastor, who was very frustrated with me at that point. But he loved me like a son. Like, he favored me above so many staffers. He paid for my seminary. He never paid for anyone's seminary. I'm like, I don't know, 50 staffers over the years, and he paid for mine. I don't even know how he justified it. Wow. He paid for my seminary, and we worked so well together, but all of these things started building, and then we saw this chasm between us. And he said, go to obedience school.
What?
And so he sent me to Singapore. This is like in the midst of my depression, which I was kind of looking for escape as well. He sent me to Singapore to this church called City Harvest Church, and they have a school there. And Singapore is like the most conformity, like one of a super high conformist country. And he wanted me to learn how to like pee in the corner, sit when he tells me to sit, you know, just be quiet and do what I say. And that was kind of their whole church culture. I remember being in the school there and asking a question. And everyone was like so offended, because if you ask a teacher a question, it means that they're not lecturing correctly. They're not giving information well. They're doing a bad job. It's like an attack.
Wow. So if you ask a question, they feel shamed.
Yeah.
Like they're embarrassed for themselves because the interpretation is like, oh, I must not have taught
really well. Or like you're attacking the teacher, like you're not telling the truth.
Interesting.
And my pastor, without saying, it's like, that's how I want you to treat me. Yeah, so after obedience school, you know, that's where I felt a call to plant. And then that's where I got fired. Yeah.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear about that season of depression. I mean, it, like, my rational brain says that makes sense, right? Given if you have no voice, if you're trying to protect the pulpit from false teachings, and that is being shot down or whatever, and you feel like no matter how much I try to protect, I'm being blocked by my boss, you know, or whatever, then that makes sense. And yet I feel really bad that you had to go through that, you know?
Like, yeah, I think a lot of EM pastors and or leaders, right, people who have been there, even if they're lay leaders, small group leaders, feel the sense of like, okay, I don't agree with the church anymore, or I see the problems,
yeah,
but I also see the people I love.
Yeah.
I see people that trust me, that love me, that I've spent like 10 years shepherding. How do I leave them? And so they don't. And so I just really want to acknowledge, you know, people who kind of feel, some people are thriving in their EM, but I think there are people who also feel trapped there because they can't leave the people that they've shepherded for so long. And I think that's what kept me there for a lot longer than, you know, maybe I should have been.
No, as you're talking, I'm trying to think about just the many situations that we find ourselves in where something's really meaningful to us, but there's just no platform for it. Or even if we are given somewhat of a platform, it's tiny, or it's being minimized, or it's being shot down. Whether it means like, even just someone who is not a leader in the church, but just someone who attends a church and just has needs, you know? And either they don't know how to express that need, or even if they are given a chance to express the need, it's not really seen as very important. You know, like what that does to someone's spirits, you know, or someone within a family, like a son or a daughter. Or I would even say sometimes there is a parent who feels like they're outnumbered. You know, like let's say the spouse is in alliance with the children, and that one parent feels like they're the odd person out, and they don't have a voice because now they're outnumbered by the other people. Like, what does that do to a person's psyche over time? Like, those are the things that kind of register in my head as you're talking about this, because this is not just a pastor issue. This is a kind of a humankind issue, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And like, I'm thinking through just even like my own journey being a part of EM, and like friends of mine, as we've sort of talked through, like, is it time yet? Is it time for us to just like move on to another church? And those conversations come up a lot. And like, to your point, a lot of it does have to do with this sense of like stagnation in EM, and this sense of like, I've grown as much as I possibly can within this context, but there is no platform. There is no like permission to sort of make this my own, or be able to kind of live out the way that I would like to live out the gospel, or see this church kind of be present in the community. And there is a lot of that. And then at the same time, like, I think about the people that are like, man, there's so many shortcomings. Like, yes, maybe I could be growing more, but like, I just want to be faithful to like this flock. And I just, you know, like, I love these people so much. And like, maybe there's a cost to that, right? Maybe there's a cost to their ability to live out certain dreams that they have for how they would like to be ministering and serving in a local church. But they've decided to be faithful in that context. Like, so I'm just thinking through, it's like, is one better than the other? Like, maybe not. And maybe not. It's a calling thing, but like, I'm just almost unpacking, like, is there an encouragement for people who are in, and I'm thinking about people who are listening, maybe they're in the end and maybe they feel like, I don't have a voice. I am in this state of frustration that I don't have a platform. Like, maybe I've voiced, you know, desires and dreams, and I just don't feel like there's people there who are ready to listen to this. And maybe it's cultural, maybe it's theological, for whatever reason it is, I don't feel like my voice matters. Is the encouragement that like, there's a different community out there, and to explore and look for that, that isn't as maybe sheltered and isn't as formed by that cultural experience?
Yeah.
Or is the encouragement like, bloom where you're planted and find a way to build bridges, find a way to navigate within the context of a very challenging immigrant dynamic, mm-hmm. and find where you can have your voice be heard. Like, is that the space to encourage? And it's probably not that dichotomy, but like, that's almost where my head goes, is like, for someone who's listening, they could go either way. Like, what would you guys say to that?
Mm. Well, I would say that some people will have a much harder time to bloom where they're planted if they come from a family background where it's just as stifling as this current church situation.
Yeah.
Because they've been so
conditioned,
accustomed to not having their voice heard, that their threshold is going to be so low. Like, no, I'm out. I am not going to bloom here. Like, I'd rather go to another place. Or in that same situation, that same kind of person, they might feel like, okay, I was muzzled in my home, but here I'm going to raise hell. You know, I'm going to make it so uncomfortable for everyone else here because I don't care what happens to me here. Hmm. But they can't do that at home because what if mom or dad disowns them?
Yeah.
Like they can't take that risk.
Yeah.
So I can see how, you know, depending on what that person's like constitutional makeup is and everything, like a lot of them are gonna get triggered in this type of church context where there's a stifling.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, I think, is because of some of their previous family experiences.
Mm.
I like it how both of your scenarios, people come from bad families. No, thanks for sharing that. You know, one of my regrets as a pastor over many years is that, and, you know, CM churches and pastors will probably really hate me for saying this, but when I did leave, I wish I took more people.
Mm.
Yeah, I think I tried to leave under radar. There was this big like confrontation night. My mom said don't go, so I didn't go.
Did you say confrontation night?
Yeah, where like I think in the next episode I'll detail out my firing, but my parents told me not to go and to basically stay under radar as I left, and there was a group of friends who came with me that were my peers. And then there was people who couldn't leave the church, right? Their parents are still there. They didn't drive, and they should be there. And then there's
they didn't drive.
No. And then there's this middle group of people that I pastored for many years that I encouraged to stay, but I should have said, hey, if you want to go with me, I will make sure you can come. Because so many of them fell out of church and never came back. So many of them felt so wounded by that experience.
Wow.
And I wish I extended an invitation to them when I decided to go. But I do think my church environment wasn't as bad, even though I said a lot of, you know, things that were hard about it. Like when you share about that dichotomy, of course, so many people have to discern that from the Lord. But I would say leave if the church itself is causing pain to people and you can't protect them. But you probably shouldn't be protecting them. So I didn't feel like, I think theology, we were really wobbly. But I think the heart of my lead pastor, the heart of the Chinese ministry was that they wanted to do right. They wanted to care for the EM.
Yeah.
And I didn't see a lot of direct harm being done intentionally.
Yeah.
There was harm done.
Yeah.
It wasn't intentional. As opposed to another church my friends grew up at, the pastor was so toxic. He would like have people stand up and shame them, right?
No.
And call them out on not doing something well. It was brutal. I'm like, everyone needs to pack their bags and leave. And if you don't have time to pack your bags, just leave your stuff and run, right? So I think kind of discerning how toxic or how harmful the actual structure is to the people there, it might lead you to a place where it's like, I'm just going to gut this church and walk out. But if it's not causing that kind of direct damage, I think there's a lot of discernment.
Right.
Because you don't want to divide up a church. I don't think that's a good thing.
I agree.
And I felt really caught in the gray of it.
Yeah.
Even as I look back now and say that, I'm like, but I don't know if it was the right decision.
It's hard to know.
I know 2020, they walked away from the Lord, you know, 20 vision. So. But that was painful to see.
Yeah, it's interesting because the other angle, like you guys both sort of from a pastoral perspective, like for me being like a layperson, it's making me think about like the EM pastors that have just really supported and nurtured like their congregation and how much I wish I had empathy for their experience being in an immigrant church. Now hearing more of the stories that you guys are unpacking and unpacking for listeners of like the realities of the struggle that's there, and especially the EM pastors that really have a heart to nurture and grow their congregation and protect them even from some of the stuff happening above them, just how much more encouragement is necessary in that journey. So maybe even an encouragement for people listening who are part of EMs to just like send that encouragement, know that extra affirmation, just knowing that it's not the easiest job.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're navigating so much, and it's easy to feel alone too. Like you're the oldest.
Yeah.
No one's in your life stage, or no one's a natural community for you.
Yeah.
I definitely feel like encouraging your EM pastor is vital to their health.
Well, I'll share a story about No Voice, and this might be kind of a peeling back the curtain for a lot of listeners as far as what probably happens in a lot of Korean churches where there is an EM. And then afterwards, we'll kind of have some closing thoughts here. So when I was pastoring as an EM pastor at a Korean church in Fullerton, one of the things I was bracing for, and I didn't quite know that this is what EM pastors were asked to do until I actually saw it with my own eyes. But so Korean immigrant churches are famous for their early morning worship services, you know, starting at like around 5 o'clock.
It's their thing.
It's their jam. So, you know, they would have the pastors wake up, give a brief sermon, lead them in songs, and have a prayer time. And you know, on a good day at 5 o'clock, there might be five people in attendance or so. Usually, they're the elderly. Okay, so at this church, the people who were required to do the driving of the elderly, you know, to the morning services, were the pastors. So I kind of heard, you know, when I went to that church, I was not the pastor. I was a congregant, but I kind of observed the other EM pastors. They had to do that thing. I was just saying, I'm glad I don't have your job, right? But then I became ordained, and sure enough, I was asked to do that. And I was thinking, okay, I have to do my regular duties for the EM, but now I have to pick up the grandmas at 4:30.
Oh,
I go to the church, I unlock the gate, I bring out the old beat up Toyota Sienna.
It's always a Toyota.
Toyota Sienna.
Oh, every time.
I make my rounds, I pick up the grandmas, I bring them in, and then and I kind of like wait. Sometimes I take a nap. Sometimes I listen, sometimes, you know, I'm listening. I think I was just, back then I was kind of turning on the ESPN radio and just listening to like early morning sports talk at like 5:30. And once they're out, I'm now driving them back home, and then I go back to my home, and now I'm resting, I just completely conked out. But there came a time where my boss, the Korean ministry pastor, said, not only do I want you to be able to pick up the grandmas, but I want you to preach in Korean.
In Korean?
I don't know how to preach in Korean. Okay, so
didn't stop Peter at Pentecost.
I wish I had the gift. So I was, you know, I said, no. He says, why don't you think about it? When he says, why don't you think about it, he's basically saying, you're going to do it.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay, I'll think about it. And then he comes back to me sometime later, okay, have you thought about it? I still don't want to do it. And he's like, no, you're going to do it. And so, you know, he was just kind of playing the game with me. And so I had to preach. So here I am now, you know, coming up with two messages. But the Korean one was like I don't have the time to look up every word and, you know, in translate it into Korean. I just don't have the bandwidth for that. So what I did was I wrote out a simple outline in English, and I said to myself, I'm just going to wing it each time. Mm. I'm going to give them my broken Korean, and, you know, and we're expected to lead them in the Lord's Prayer. I don't know how to read Korean that fast. And so I'm telling the congregation, okay, let's do the Lord's Prayer. They're all kind of speeding along, and I'm just kind of mumbling my word. Singing the hymns. I'm leading them and singing the hymns. And I can't read it that fast. I'm just kind of I'm giving this sermon, and like there are long, awkward pauses in between every sentence because I'm trying to translate it in my head from English to my broken Korean.
Yeah.
And sometimes oftentimes I'm using the wrong word, and I get through it, and I'm sweating bullets, and I go back there, and I remember when I was driving the grandma's home, they told me, oh, what a good message you gave. I said, oh, really? I said, what did you understand? And they're telling me what they understood. They completely missed the point of what I was trying to say. So I knew that my preaching was
grandmas.
Yeah. Bless those grandmas.
Bless those grandmas.
I did that maybe, you know, after like my third time, I pretty much, I had it. Like I reached my threshold. After I give my broken Korean sermon, I go into the back room. It's like this is where the Korean pastors congregate. And there's like this big plexiglass window that you can kind of look out into the sanctuary. And so while the people are praying, I'm talking to the associate pastor, who is the on the Korean side. And I'm venting to him. Mm. I'm telling him, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Number one, could we get maybe a rotation of...
They wanted you to do it just you forever, like every day forever.
Okay, granted, it wasn't every day, but one day was one day too many for me, right? And, you know, I asked them, couldn't we get maybe a rotation of maybe deacons who are up in the morning anyway, right? They have some sort of like a, you know, maybe they're morning people. And can we get like a rotation of like 20 deacons? Because it's a, you know, sizable congregation where they could joyfully drive these grandmas.
Yeah.
And number two, why am I preaching in Korean when I don't even know how to speak Korean? Like, I know like really broken, I can order at the restaurant, but I don't know how to speak theological Korean at all.
Right.
Like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And what this associate pastor said to me was maybe the pulling of the card from the house of cards that just was the beginning of the end for me.
Mm.
He said to me, using like what they call in Korean, 반말. 반말 is when you speak kind of down to a person because you can. You are the one in higher position, so you can speak down to the next person. So he said to me in 반말, hey, don't you know that pastors need to suffer in order to make the people's faith grow bigger?
Blood of the martyrs.
Blood of the martyrs.
Oh my goodness.
I felt chills down my spine. Mm. And I was thinking, at last, the curtain is peeled back on this whole... The matrix is now revealed to me. I'm understanding why you guys do this.
Yeah.
Because your mindset is,
the
more you guys suffer, the more the congregation grows.
That's
like,
so sadistic.
Right? It's sadistic.
Yeah.
And yet they firmly believe that. I don't know whether that is in the water in Korea mm. where they really believe that, and now they bring that mentality to these chores. Mm. But now I'm understanding what you're expecting me to do. Mm. And I'm like, internally, I'm thinking, I'm not having any of it.
Yeah.
I am not going to be part of this type yeah. of mentality.
Yeah.
And so that was the beginning of the end.
Mm.
And I realized that I used my voice. I spoke out first to the head pastor saying, no, I don't want to do this. I've got a lot of things to do on my plate.
Yeah.
I want to do those things excellently. But he's like, no, you're going to do it. And now I'm speaking, I'm using my voice
yeah.
to this associate, and
yeah.
he's the one who's revealing the matrix to me.
Yeah.
So I realize,
wow,
even if I have a voice, it's futile.
Yeah.
Because the system is too strong.
Right.
And so I wonder whether the listeners understand... Like you were talking about empathy for the EM pastors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wonder whether there are listeners who have an EM pastor that's part of a CM or a KM or a JM or whatever it is, and there are certain things where they just cannot have a pathway for
yeah.
their own
yeah.
sanity,
yeah,
their
yeah,
own
yeah.
voice to be heard.
Mm.
And if so, what is their threshold? Like, because... You know, do they have another job lined up if they were to quit? And I do know of quite a few pastors as well who they feel like, this church is all that I have. Like, not just financially speaking, this is my
yeah.
family.
Yeah.
If I lose this family, where do I go?
Mm.
And so
they invest
they have
everything then.
No recourse
yeah.
but to stay in that sadistic culture where, like, I better put up with this or else I'm going to lose everything.
Mm.
And I feel so bad for them.
Mm.
You know, again, going back to the mental health, like, what does that do to a person where if I don't put up with what's being fed to me, then I lose everything.
Mm, yeah. It's so interesting because you mentioned that even when you had a voice, it was like the voice was there, but the acknowledgement of your personhood almost wasn't. There's almost a loss of personhood and that dignity of just, like, the image of God is, like, kind of what was coming to mind for me. Like, it went beyond just, like, is there an avenue to be heard?
Right.
To, like, is who I am as a person valuable? Is my personal mental health and well-being as an individual, like, does that matter to the church?
It doesn't matter... And I feel weird even saying this because I'm showing empathy for their position.
Yeah.
Like, for them, they truly believe that by suffering, you are helping the church,
mm.
right? And so what does our mental health matter if the bigger picture is that the congregants are being inspired by the suffering of
the
pastors?
Oh, it's the inspiration. Like, this is what you're willing to give up for the
this
Lord.
This is what you're willing to give up for the
mm.
Lord. And so isn't God such a great God that you would be able to, you know, do this for the Lord?
Yeah.
For the glory of the Lord, you know? So, yeah, it's a interesting thing that I stumbled upon. And I don't think that this is an isolated incident by any means,
mm.
you know? So that being said, I mean, you know, some closing remarks for this particular episode about voice. What do you guys, what are you coming away with now that we've been talking about this?
I mean, I guess, like, one thought that I didn't have until we had this conversation, because I think my natural inclination is toward, like, bloom where I'm planted, right? And kind of, like, let's, like, try to make it work and build those bridges for better or worse, right? But I guess at a certain point, is it so toxic / unhealthy that allowing an EM to collapse, is that grace? Is saying, like, I need to step away, not only for my own well-being, but even because, like, this environment isn't healthy for me to be present, to try to keep the ball rolling, trying to almost, like, sustain something that isn't actually healthy at its very core.
Mm.
And I guess I just wonder if there is certain communities of immigrant churches where there is so much going on there with the power dynamics, with that cultural element that maybe even dominates the way that the gospel is perceived. Like, I think there is like a, like just what you were sharing in terms of like, what does it mean to be holy, or what does it mean to like be in a leadership pastoral position? That means, you know, like stifle yourself. And it's the, maybe the extreme of like, take up your cross and follow me kind of a thing, where like, it's about the suffering. It's about like taking up my cross. And maybe there's a almost perversion a little bit of the gospel in that. And so I guess that is my maybe last thought as you were sharing, Roy, is like, is that a grace at times to step away from a ministry where your very presence or my very presence in that ministry, trying to build those bridges, is actually perpetuating something that is unhealthy.
Like enabling a really bad system.
Enabling that system when stepping away actually reveals the issues, like sends a stronger message to the leadership to say something is really wrong.
That's a powerful question.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Jenna. I think about this time where me and my family member, we got in a really bad argument, and she's always been super strict with me. She grew up in like high society, so every time we ate, there was like all this table manners that I had to adhere to, and she would call me out very strongly when I was a kid. And now I'm like 26, we're sitting in the living room just like this, I'm meeting like her husband's family, and I'm sitting in a way that she didn't like. Mm. And she's like, hey, don't sit like that. Sit like this. Mm. In front of like 30 people that I don't know. Mm. Which is ironic to me, because like, you're telling me to be polite, but that was super rude, right? Your politeness is rude. So I do it because I don't, you know, I just kind of roll over. But later I remember bringing her to my room when we got to my place. And I sat her down, she's older than me, and I said, you know, I'm an adult now, because she's talking to me like I was 5, 6, 7. Mm. And I said, I still want to learn from you. I still want to learn like manners and what's appropriate, but I want you to correct me with boundaries, right? So like, talking to me in front of everyone is not appropriate, but if you pull me aside and let me know, like, I will listen. And I said, you know, my parents have treated me like adults. My parents are actually really great at how they build boundaries over my life, where they changed the way they spoke to me. Yeah. I said, you know, I would like you to talk to me like my parents who respect me as an adult. Yeah. And then she said, okay. And then she didn't talk to me ever again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She just, whenever we were in the same room, she would pretend I didn't exist.
Wow.
Yeah. And my dad wanted me to make up with her, but I didn't know how, because I felt like I put clear boundaries up that I felt like were fair, but to her, it's like, she's as Chinese as they come. Mm. So what's fair to her is, I'm older, you listen, right? But
That's interesting.
But I wish that she could share maybe her hurt, or we could work on the boundary, but we have to have clear boundaries and we have to agree to those boundaries. Just like expectations. You have to speak about your expectations and then agree with the other party. You can't hold me to an expectation you never told me about. And I think with the EM Chinese side, you know, kind of blending the family with the church concept, like I think we have to have very clear communication with boundaries. And come to a point sometimes where it's like, hey, we just can't play in each other's sandbox. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we don't know how to share our toys, and we're having this enmeshed sandbox experience. Or hey, let's agree to rules and really try to respect them. We're both probably compromising more than we want to, because we're bringing two cultures together. But at least it's out in the open, and we know what rules we're playing with. Like, if the rule is pastors have to suffer, then you opted out of that, right?
At least I'm clear now on what the rules are, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Maybe there
needs to be more sit-downs to discover, hey, are we playing by Monopoly rules, or are we playing by, like,
tag?
You know, what are we playing here?
Put that game?
So like that, because the longer that it stays somewhat nebulous, like, it's just going to be confusing and prolonged. But if I realize, no, you're playing Monopoly, and I'm not quite sure whether I want to play Monopoly.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't think I'm being a sinner by saying I don't want to play Monopoly.
Yeah.
Then maybe that is exit time.
Yeah.
Maybe that is a go in peace time, if such a thing can exist, you know. But I think clarity can actually help.
I think so.
But that takes courage to actually have that confrontational meeting.
I
really enjoyed talking about the issue of voice with you guys. I'm really thankful for you both. And, you know, for your listeners, I hope that something made you feel like you're not alone, that there are others in the same boat as you. And so if you have any questions or comments, I misspoke in the first episode. It's not sameboatpod@gmail.com. The actual email is thesameboatpod@gmail.com. So go ahead and send us a line if you're so inclined. And please disembark safely.